I have a number of announcements, so I'll start right away. Can you hear me in the back? Yes? Okay. The next poetry reading that I know of in town is at the University of Arizona next Wednesday, October 1st at 8:30 in the Terrace Room of the Student Union. Michael Cudahy, a local poet, and Susan Lowell Humphreys, a member of the University of Arizona writing faculty, will be reading. Michael will be reading his poetry and Susan her fiction. Then on October 13th, also at the university, this time in the Modern Languages Auditorium, Stephen Spender will be reading. The next reading at Pima will be by Jeff Carter. That will be on October 16th, also at 8:30 right here. I know this can get bewildering, and I suggest that you pick up a schedule from the University of Arizona Poetry Center to keep track of their readings, and one of these days we'll have something published for our series. We don't yet, so I suggest that you call student activities here, or once the schedules are out, I'll make sure that the Poetry Center at the university gets them, and you can check with them. In the meantime, we'll keep announcing and we'll keep sending material to the newspapers. The rest of our series this year will include, among many others, Abelardo Delgado, Norman Doobie, Gwendolyn Brooks, and Simon Ortiz. Another activity that I'm sure many of you will be interested in is an exhibit of paintings by Gail Marcus Orland, which will be right around the corner in the gallery in this building. That will be from September 29th to October 17th. September 29th is Monday, and there will be a reception that night from 6 to 8 p.m. Tonight, I have great pleasure in introducing Steve Orland. Steve has been writing very good poetry for a good many years, and many people wondered when he would have a book out. He does have one now called Sleeping on Doors, a chapbook put out by Penumbra Press in Lisbon, Iowa. In the meantime, of course, even before his book came out, he was publishing in many, many magazines and journals, including Kayak, Ironwood, Poetry, Iowa Review, Poetry Northwest, New American Review, others. Among his awards, he received a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship in 1974. I'm sure that at the university, Steve is not only admired for his poetry, but I think he's very much loved for his teaching and his always willing advice for young poets. And it's a great pleasure to introduce Steve Orland. Thank you. I want to start with a poem called The Secret. I know I'm among friends, but can't help but be nervous in front of all of them. First poem is called The Secret. I left a Mexican coin to confuse her. I left it in the drawer with her mementos, letters to and from the dead, the oval portrait of her sister. Love must keep its secrets, but not its hidden things. The day turned dark. After dinner, I slid the brass coin in among the seeds and the lush flesh of a watermelon. It disappeared, the lover's version of a magic trick to resurrect mysterious strangers. Love must keep its secrets between bathroom and kitchen, and in the marriage chamber. We try to sleep. In a dream, she finds the coin wedged between her breasts. Lovely in my bed, she dreams of other men and unfamiliar places. By morning, she needs a bus trip. She's bored. I know. I left the Mexican coin to distract her from love and its mischief, eyes making eyes at strangers as we pass. Across the aisle, I watch her finger it in her blue jeans pocket, smooth it, make it lucky. Such wearing down takes years. The bus stops in Mexico City. We lie together, two strangers in a painted bed. We hardly know each other well enough, she whispers, to undress in this humid dark. Stars drift above the skylight. The hours pass. I think I am falling in love with the need for fiction. May such shy coinage multiply. The coin glows between us. The coin knows. The next poem is called The Drunken Man, and it's the kind of situation with which everybody's familiar. When your friend is drunk or the other guy is drunk and you're not, and how do you, the communication gets mixed up. The drunken man. There's nothing you can say to a man who drinks. He rises in the gray mist of morning and lights his cigarette, knowing that soon he'll be elsewhere. Out in the world, the old men sweep their shops and one barber nods. The full-breasted woman airing her pillows, she smiles and squints, and seeing it is only him, she closes the window. But it doesn't matter. There's no way of hurting a man who drinks. His wife floats in his pockets. His father twists open the cap. His mother whispers, drink, drink. He moves on down the street. There are times when you feel obligated to speak. You take your hands from your pockets. You slide your glass away from him. In earnest, you'll say something, anything, the weather, your son, and he'll argue at you from some place you can't know because you're not a drunk. Perhaps when you stagger home, your wife screams to shut up, come to bed like a man. Your face reddens, your shoes drop, you burrow into her flesh. But a drunk is like a cloud, is like a ship that sinks but never drowns, is like a feather bed. Already it is noon. His mother and his father are half gone. He's weightless now. Don't waste your pity on a drunken man. There are too many of him, and your breasts are too few. At night in the bar, you are his weakness, his hope, and his family. If you argue back, if you arm wrestle him, if the bartender is embarrassed by your antics, it's time to go home. Go home. Go home to your noisy wife. Next poem is called Beauty and the Beast, and the situation as it unfolds in the poem is a little chaotic, but I think that I've asked enough people whether it comes across, and it seems to. Somebody, a little girl, requests entrance into something, into a dream, into the woods, into your house, and eventually in the narrative of the poem, the little girl gets bitten badly by a dog. That's basically the situation. Beauty and the Beast. The little girl speaks occasionally in the poem. Let me in. The four-year-old in printed dress and rubber boots knocks on the door in the white woods. A jackrabbit scurries invisibly across the fragile roof of snow and hides behind the rotted oak. The coyote, lion, and half-blind, dumb, wild pig remain asleep inside. All this occurred before the dream of a girl turned into a beast, the pink scar tensing the mouth in a permanent grin of aftermath, the one wide-open, improbable eye. But it's only a dream, she cries, and couldn't happen to a princess. Though it was afternoon, I slept. And whatever takes place in my dream, I am faultless and a child again. The mother watches from the window, idly watering flowers, and the large, black, stubborn dog mounting his mate on an endless ladder. For him, this is a dream twice yearly of the maddening odor of bish into which he strives to growl. "Let me in," says the princess. The dream's unlocked teeth plunge into her face. The face in the window, the face in the dream ripped half off like a door from its hinge. Blood rushing from the bared skull onto the pure white dream of snow over which she trudges crazily home. Up, horsey. Whoa, horsey, whoa. There is no horse, no princess, no beast from fairy tales. Only a dog dreaming of bullets raining down like bad weather and a man slamming a car door. At the dream's end, she whispers, "Let me in." And I wake, sweating, in a room with a strange, one-eyed, improbable princess by my side. For a long time, I tried to write poems that seemed to me to be lyrics, seemed to me to be lyrical poems, song-like. And I wrote some, and some were successful, and a lot weren't. But at some point, I realized that writing a lyric wasn't my strength, that something like a narrative seemed to be the direction I had been fighting and the direction I should have been going in for a long time. It took me a long time to realize that. This is a poem that I think is about, it's a short poem, it's a lyric poem, about a tendency to write stories, narrative poems. It's called Tranquilities. Someone is pushing a stone out of place, and someone is pushing it back, gently, without intention. I wanted to write a lyric while the world slept. I wanted to write your name. But the hours passed, the gray light seeped through my curtain. Children gathered in groups on the streets, then broke and went their long ways. A story unfolded, partial and without relief, the details so intimate, for the moment I forgot your name. I give you events and later tranquilities. Next poem is called Street Fighter. And it's part truth and part fiction, but the incident behind it is one in which a friend of mine who's used to fighting was called out two or three times in one night by different people in different bars. And for some reason, he just wasn't in the mood for it. He just couldn't do it. One of the reasons was he had just gotten new teeth. And he didn't want to get them busted. So, but the next morning, early in the morning, when I saw him, he was feeling, I guess he was feeling some sort of cowardice over it, and he had to confess it to me. And the poem was about that, the response to that, Street Fighter. Last night, two young Chicanos called him out, flat and simple as a threat of rain. He tells me how his streetwise mind imagined left arm cocked, elbow a greased socket, and how he rose from the bar stool and left. All morning, I've tagged along in silence and will not be provoked. He stops at the corner. The wooden grill of noon flames his face, his new teeth, the false caps of porcelain as yet unpaid for. When a man confesses cowardice while waiting for the light to change, it is an act of faith. I am a mouth to blame, mouth to forgive, mouth to explain that nothing matters. But this brute man whose strengths I forgive before his weaknesses will not be moved. The brain grunts, refuses, the muscles stall. Above his eyes, the glazed scars twitch and fade like old tattoos. I want to say, age gives us courage to deny some fool's left hook bad night, but what's the use? At 35, he still slicks his hair back like a hoodlum. He turns and waves. His moon face shrinks in the sun with worry. Where we grew up, a good fight was a way of keeping friends. So I run towards him and cold cock him and feel his new teeth crumble in my fist. It is one punch too few, though I believe he must go easier for trusting me his shame, and worse for having begun this day the wrong way twice. Dumb with rage, he prowls the avenues, will not be denied. The next is a series of four fairly short poems, all of which were written at different times, all about marriage, problems of marriage, whatever. I realized at some point that they seemed to go together, so I linked them under the obvious title of marriage poems. The moods in each poem are different. Some serious, some seem lighter than others. But the writing is pretty much the same, so I felt they linked up together. The marriage poems. In the gallery, my mistakes repeat themselves. I take aim, I repeat. Small sins, less pleasure. We kiss our mistresses, they kiss us back. Let's face it, I'm middle class. Even when I run from my wife, I keep running into her. I wear grooves so deep, I sleep in them. Sex falters, but the trail mysteriously gets itself up over the next hill. And everywhere I go, I follow pain. If it's comfortable, it's boring. If it's romantic, I go insane. If each step were a different stairway, we'd get lost. And each love a new woman, we'd get dizzy falling at such speed and never hit bottom, riding, riding. All night we locked our doors, the hard, sad mouths. We stalked naked, bedroom to bathroom, shining like scissors, like silver, like crosses. When we lie down, tell me what slips between us, self-conscious. We sleep in a coffin, in satin, a wedding, waiting for morning. Look how we look away, revelations that can almost touch. Are we the honesties? We are stars that blink in our night clothes, like slow-turning planets filled with other lies. In the middle of marriage, a sameness and a loss no one's love can sustain. When you have gone, I rush downstairs to greet you. When you were here, I forgot. Over the bare hill of the bed, our absence arrives. It fills up space. We are loveless, though our orbits touch. What is forgiven will hurt. We toss and sleep, sharing regrets, sharing our loneliness. Without photographs of ancestors, without tiny gold watches to wind. To learn to love again, the angel detaches her wings and sleeps. On this, the coldest night, the self rises over and over again. Walls the same, bed the same, ashes in the grate. And if a stranger arrives with blood on his lips and promises, send him away, for it is not yet spring. Outside the door, the snow falls like the passing of hours, with such patience, such abandon. I haven't read in a long time, and it's supposed to get easier after a while, but it doesn't seem to do it. I've written a lot of poems about loss, about looking back on childhood or some earlier point in my life. So I've got a lot of details of childhood in several of the poems. This next poem, which is called My Father's House, interested me because the nostalgia in the poem is not really from my childhood. It's from my father's childhood, which is strange. He talked so much about it and in such lovely terms, the way it was better in the old days, those kinds of things, that I grew up thinking, in a sense, that his childhood was my own, the same kinds of details of gas lamps and horse and buggies, that kind of thing. Here's a poem about that. My father's house. Seen from a great distance through the morning mist, under a fathering elm, returning home for no good reason, the house invites like those mansions framed in photographs, raw edges disguised by trees, and a dog activating the yard almost to drama. It is an old home, built and built over by my father's father in late Victorian. It is porched and screened in and almost black. In 1950, we were safe and overslept on Sundays behind Venetian blinds. Without a past, this house would invent us. Each room is a small town, settled on and favored. These are the walls that knew their place. This the bureau with the decal lamb and the mirror with nothing but eyes. This is the house that kept on growing. I am grateful for my father's past, mine, as a dream belongs to me, 1909. On our walk, he points out odd memorials. Here a horse passed every day, smell the droppings. Here he broke his leg at soccer and rode his bike home, and the darn bone poked through his pants, my pain. Some people stray far from their childhoods into a future they never planned. Even by continual walking, they will not return. They forget by sleeping and love without last names. Often I want to walk out of doors like a stranger holding my own hand, to be mistrusted, as when a guest in a lapse of conversation turns over a globe of snow and dreams a pleasant country scene. Here in my father's house, the world pulls in around me like a sheep, and I am memorizing hats and closets, rings and secret places, windows masked with an inner shine. Outside, gas lamps light the street, and in the front room, gazing at a passing horse and a man yelling, rags, rags, building the first radio in town, son of a son of a son, waiting to hear the first crackling of a distant man's real voice over wire. This is an old poem that came back to me. I think I wrote this next one about 5 or 6 years ago. And it came back to me twice in the last couple of weeks, so I thought I'd bring it back. I put it aside. A friend of mine had suggested I resurrect it and put it in a manuscript. And a fellow that I met in a bar a couple of weeks ago, whom I didn't know, one of Nard Taze's students, said he knew of me through that poem. So here it is. It's called Keeping Watch. In his backyard, he preserves the smallest reminders of his nakedness. Now and then, something comes over him like rain on sleeping dogs. Termites crawl out of tiny eggs, eat the marvelous wood, and the rainwater will flush them like cells through clogged veins. They drown right in front of his eyes. At twilight, he watches as if he were God, the butcher without hands to flay his beef, the landlord who is always elsewhere with the food in his back pocket. Each thing eats the thing smaller without remorse or punishment. This is what he's been told to keep quiet about. At night, the air breaks like glass. He steps through like a scar, the hearing messenger, the angel of insects who has lost his way. As if an egg bursts beneath his thickening skin, he locks his thighs and tells them this is all there is. Next poem is called Country House. And about 2 or 3 years ago, my wife and I moved up to Oracle, and which is, many of you know, is a beautiful town, beautiful country up there. And despite the fact that we had good neighbors and good friends up there, I found out again that I wasn't a country boy. Bruce is one of our good neighbors. Anyway, so the sense of it out there taught me that, though I enjoyed it, that I should come back to town. That's where I belong. Country house. Oh, there's some reference you might not know. There's the name of a Russian river called the Dnieper, Dnieper, mentioned in the poem. This house is old, too small to contain lives furnished with smog, TV, divorce. The trees I drag like errant children from the hills are squandered in the fireplace. The coyotes howl at nothing, a fiction, a household in the woods. This antique bed would rot in some garage, but for my sentiment. Gullies without pipes, land without the small dots of houses cozy in tracts, waste their scars. We are the new outlanders, here for rest and a taste of our father's blood. We gorge on fresh upcountry air, breed violent flowers whose incessant odor frightens and consoles. I imagine my father in this house, child of heart-struck immigrants, dreaming of hard work and a fast buck. He stands on a street corner in a shally hat and knickers, hustling papers under a gas lamp. Whose past does he romanticize? The sour smell of pigs? A Russian slum? No gain in that. Why do we love what's gone? The innocence we enshrine in sepia of Sunday picnics under the Dnieper is equal to our own false lies, greed, and deceit. Therefore, we live small in a country house and send out vines. When autumn comes, we crush the plump fruit into wine, drowse by the fire, and pump our children full of a past that was sweet, a future ruined before their time. Here's another poem from Is there an ashtray? Can't miss, huh? This is a poem called Tobacco Farms. When I was a kid, summers, when I was 13, 14, 15 years old, I picked tobacco. And there were, this was up in New England, which is an odd place to grow tobacco. They just grew the outside leaf on cigars. It was cheap tobacco, I guess. But anyway, there were acres and acres of fields, and they were all under white nets. It was called shade tobacco, just gauze nets that stretched acres and acres. And there were posts. There, you know, tobacco grows in rows, and there were posts every 10 feet or so. And early picking, you know, the lower leaves you drag along on your knees, and then if it gets a little higher, the leaves get a little higher, you stand up, and then finally in last picking, it's easy. You just go down the rows like this. Anyway, this is just a short recollection of those times. Tobacco farm. Under acres of white net, the boy crawls on hands and knees. He thinks too much. He worries about God and sex and death. Sometimes he'd like to lie in the damp row and dream. But this is piecework, 12.5 cents a bend. Heat blazes under the nets, but mornings the dew is cool. At lunch, the straw boss brings beer. He watches the Polish immigrant, his nose in a grammar book. He's already learned the vocabulary of fuck this and fuck that. On the truck ride home, the boy thinks of a cool bath, supper, and sleep. Tonight, Babs Beach, a dance with the Pennsylvania girls. He'll drink, maybe he'll fight. He'll watch the stars wheel over the curing barn. Meanwhile, Ace Cody's got a new tattoo. The fat kid jiggles his tits like a woman. Monday, another field, the same river of nets all the way to the sea. Not yet 15, and his father says he knows too much. Thank you. This is a poem about another friend, or partly about another friend. Nothing much to say, but it's called No Quarter. place in the city. Limping among the hookers and drunks, he tells me he's done it all. He's done it everywhere, as hunter and hunted, his wide mouth open. Tonight he seems boyish. His head is strangely large for his body. He's brooding because his father left the sea for a woman, and that's bad luck for a Portuguese. Now one brother's in jail, and the other sits banging his head against walls. The bars along the side streets are slowly closing. After hours, the silences between the squares of the city keep us at arm's length, a kind of grace, and the passing girls refuse his glance. Here is his motto, he says. Here is what he means beyond the details of a life. No love, no loss. He pauses at the alley's mouth. He leans into my listening face and says he's meaner than any man, and points to his face for proof. The chipped teeth and caved-in portions of brow are the bad debts of a thief who preys on thieves. In the black alley, he searches among the tangled veins and the scarred crook of his arm for the path from heart to brain, the softest sack, where there is no love and no loss, no temptation to exist beyond this resting place. He fixes me with his small blurred eyes to say he's never killed except by accident, scared that he will, then squeezes me to show how gentle he is, my pal, my shadow more loving than any man. What time is it? Okay. Got time? Okay. This next poem is called First Story. And it's, I usually have more jokes to tell or something, but for some reason all I can think of is to read the poem. So, if you want to laugh once in a while, or, well, I don't know what it is. This is a poem I wrote when I was rereading a lot of the old Jack London stories. You know, boy goes up, or man goes up to the northern wilderness and fights off a wolf, that kind of thing. And I was getting that boyish adventure, excitement, rising in me again. And I remembered a story, something that had happened to me when I was a kid. I used to take a certain route home from school through some woods in winter, and at one point found a human hand coming up through the snow. I sat down by it and looked at it for a while. And it was one of those things my father and I had though we never got along, it was the kind of relationship where I told him just about everything that happened to me. And this I kept secret. So I guess it was important to me because it was a kind of, little kids got to learn how to lie and keep secrets. And it took me longer than most to learn how to do that. Eventually we found out when the snow went away in spring, it was some old drunken bum or something like that who had fallen asleep and bought it from the snow. And it was also, I guess, my first experience with some kind of death. Okay, the poem is called First Story. And at the end of every stanza, there is a Jack London kind of story about a guy up in the North Woods who's wounded and a wolf is coming after him. And I'll sort of indicate when those lines come. Thick snow, the path, an evergreen hung above an ice-locked stream. Home through the woods, he found a hand upthrusting from the snow. His dog growled. The hand was frozen blue. He was afraid to tell his father, whom he told all his secrets, afraid to touch the stiff, curled fingers or enter the cave of palm. But numb with winter, he came back to sit in the widening circle of story. A man lay by a northern stream, lost in trout depths, feverish. His gashed leg refused to heal. That night, the wolf returned to snarl. Sunday, when the others knelt... Sunday, when the others knelt in church, He pressed the blue fire of palm and bound their hands in prayer. He passed out in the pitiless snow. The tree let down its branches over a boy who could not stay away from the dead or the soon-to-be dead. And an owl from a storybook sang of another world, the underground. It snowed and the stream froze up and dark clouds hid the stars. In his dream, they were friends, wolf and man, under a shell of dark. Far off in the upper world, the miraculous living moved. Nothing ended but the day. A father storied his son to sleep. Children woke and went to school. The boy moved through them, a ghost, counting the unborn nails of his hand. Cold voices urged him back to the woods. Under the tree, a story was ending. And when he died, steam rose from his flesh. The wolf moaned and ran. The body slipped under snow. Then spring and the snow loosed over rock to unveil a man's body. He watched them wrap it in a sack and saw that the eyes were blind, the mouth too dumb for grief or story. But their hands had locked, friends one whole winter, until the stream broke and blessed him with its cold skill. He heard icy veins roaring underground. He didn't know the dead could live so long, nor pain, nor numbness end. This is a poem called The Jewish Family. Someone once told me that some editor didn't like my poems because he didn't like the way I treated the Jewish theme. The Jewish Family. Mother's on her bed playing solitaire, refusing to sleep. Why is she suddenly old and bitter and without sex to save her? Or pills to put her under like a little girl. There's father striding the huge cracks because nothing is wrong, dignified in his long coat like a paintbrush, spreading sickness, smiles, and fix it. When we can't sleep, we roll over and over. We make up stories to fit the bad things, and by turns we are heroes or victims. When we can't remember, what's to become of us? One night we decided to be heroes, to kiss our enemies until they were Jewish. Then the grocer refused us credit. Then it took forever just to make mistakes. Whose story is this? Whose lifetime? No one's to blame. We dawdle around the table like wisely unattempted lives, totaling up our accounts. This pain is for father, for looking away, for frowning. This pain is for mother who keeps it inside and sickens into gallstones, into one lonely breast. Remember the house, Daddy, bristling with sores that wouldn't scar, and the cops who kept finding me under pillows and porches, sooty and weeping, confessing. Every friend I have is a hoodlum. Every girl I take is a bad girl with toothless parents and dirty hair, and I fall forever for our sins. If you love me, Daddy, do it good. Beat me up laughing, not crying like a sorry old man. Why is love like dying? Why don't we ever leave home? Wasn't all that bad. This is a poem called Beverly, and it's about the girl upstairs, and Beverly was the girl who introduced all the guys in the neighborhood to the joys of sex. And this is a memory called In Praise of Beverly. When you walked downstairs and touched my root, God knows what brought you homing there. Barely 14, already known as the town pump and proud of your clear attributes. I don't think we ever kissed, but lay in a rocky ditch all one awful summer night, alive, in love with heat. At dawn, we toasted marshmallows, and when the fire caught the weeds and lit the hillside, you held me tight and whispered, "Let's wait and see the fire engines come." You got sent up early to the house of Good Shepherd because the mothers were jealous. Forgive them. When the friendly, leering cop told me, "I heard you dip the wick in Beverly," I blushed and stammered, proud, then lied, forgive us all, to save my skin. Beverly, the night they took you away, I imagined myself in the ditch, my flesh on fire, curled against your careless breathing, plotting love. I dreamt your face and your hands that parted the dark were mine and groaned to share your misery, but I found mine in good time. Find that one. This is called Versions of Departure. And it's three short poems about leaving home. The first is about leaving home as a little kid to go to kindergarten or whatever. The second section is a boy, maybe 12 years old or so, who wants to run away from home and is out in the yard late at night and doesn't quite make it. And the third is about an adult returning to a place like his home and then departing from it. It starts as my bald father rises to put me off to school and kisses my turned cheek, undoing all that my night's dreaming has done. Down the walk to the street, the sky descends through the torn kite of the elm. The high hedge bristles. I try not to notice the grisly worms underfoot, or the mutt named Jeep whimpering on the third-story porch, or my mother in her gown behind the bedroom curtains. The year is 1948. For a moment, nothing moves. Then I hear the screen door click shut, as though my father had taken a snapshot. Dragging my feet, my father's son, I turn and wave to the faces afloat in the window. Wave and turn away towards school. Sleepwalking in a grove of lilac, he turns toward the darkened house. His bedroom window yawns, half open. Then toward the barn, the city hills and woods, and beyond, the far spaces. At night, this backyard is not safe for a boy who dreams of running away. The nail on the jump-up fence snares his cuff. Overhead, a basketball hoop creaks on its final pin, and the old boxer in the hayloft, champ of shadow boxing, cries out, wakes to his phantoms. Something has happened between a boy and his father. Now, still dreaming, he shinnies up to the elm's highest bower, and in the shagged, pinched crotch, he talks to himself. He waits for his older brother to try his pale shoulders on the lawn. He waits for Eggman's truck to arrive, crying the fruits of the earth, looking for lice in a small boy's hair. No one sees a boy wondering, weaving out of the green dark, a shape for himself, a story, a place to be. The sun setting, the hills on fire, the house and yard smaller than they seemed before. I came to see winter afternoon darken to supper time. The stove is hot, the table laid. But this time, the child refused to go home because of the stars appearing like unspent wishes and the path from the white yard, a strip heading deeper into woods. Far off, a woman slams a door. A tired man quarrels with his stew. I came for what the child saw. Standing just outside his life, though the seeing was brief, the house a stranger's, the light in the kitchen window fainter than any light I'd seen before. It's a poem. I'll just read a few more. There's a poem called The Perfect One. And it arose from a sentence somebody once spoke to me that I didn't like very much, but I guess he was right. He told me that he didn't understand women very well, as if they were somehow different creatures. And the poem came out of that criticism, and it's called The Perfect One. My friend tells me I don't understand women. A good question to ask myself in private. Consider my suicides, my wives, who gave birth to me daily. Under their wings, I was slick and charming. They were the coddlers who kept me. To the shadows of their breasts, I brought my grief. But the man, the elusive one, hid his eyes and slept. Consider the advice my mother gave me, wheezing on her knee. Never marry a girl who can't sing in your sleep. I never did. I couldn't find her. I lay awake. A boy takes wives by being forcefully inept. A man steps into a woman's life by being blunt. But mother's gone the way of most perfection, and father turned out to be right after all. When I was crazy, I touched a tree and asked it what it was beyond itself. I think I suffered a long time without knowing. In the mornings, a lady comes to rouse me. She is not my lover. She is not my mother. She is the future, and she is desperate to please me. When she hands me my toothbrush, I tell her, "Wait, you are the perfect one. I can see right through you." In the next bed, my father writes, "Everything will happen in its time." I had a dream last night in which she came for me. "I'm not ready," I said, but she was all smiles like the bark of a tree. As I grew smaller, she grew more perfectly large. Then she found it, my birthmark, and entered my body through that one remaining hole without teeth. "Get out," I told her. "You're just like me." She smelled like death as I breathed her out. All of this is written in the book my father wrote. This is an older poem, and it's the title poem of the chapbook that I just published, and it's called Sleeping on Doors. It's for Carol Marcus, 1946 to 1969. If we could only see further, we could look through to the other side. Such impossibilities, the death of a sister in August, leave us standing in a kingdom of tongues without mouths, without even silence to contain our doubts. When we sigh, we encounter her breathing. To each ghost we assign lamentations, like zeros, like seeds. We would people whole accessible universes with our need, entrances, exits, as if we could accept loss forever. Tonight is the first closed door, the stone, and we lie down on it. Sleep on the door, sleep on the door. A way of seeing past the darkness, as though we could come and go as we pleased. Getting down to the end. This is a poem called The Last Whore, and it's about two men. The two characters in the poem are on an island, and at the edge of the island, of the big city in the island, is a place called La Perla, which is the red light district. The Last Whore. Midnight, and the red lights waken in La Perla at the island's edge. Along the seawall, cold-eyed sharks in business suits lean and advise. If I were Juan, the fisherman, and foolish with the tired man's face. I would start up from shore and enter the first beached whale of flesh. But these are the tourist tropics, my friend Federico explains, where love swarms and the women are flowering out of every door. Even the wine of the cripple selling ices blooms into song. Upstairs in the Rose of Lima ballroom, we watch two lesbians fondle each other on stage in a velvet bed. Their breasts are purple bruises spreading over the sailors and cruising girls, over my friend who says he loves all women. Though he is rich and their time is money, they sit for what he offers around the table scarred with drink. Lily, the black Dominican, flares across the room. Tattooed spiders clamber up her thighs. They talk and drink, bargain and refuse, until she is soft, approximate, turning the way his hands turn, like a block of wood on a lathe. Given the right word or the whim, or whatever moves us to break faith with what we know, she might walk out and settle on the outskirts of Ciudad Trujillo, proprietress of bar or beauty shop, and my friend go home to his loving daughter and his Cuban wife. And yet, as she turns, the vowels he shapes but does not speak are like the marked words of wisdom in a borrowed book. Just under the sheet, the last name chosen from a field of flowers steals his breath and pushes him past the spider gate. He is the last of many to enter the wide, accustomed dark. They drift on the bed toward dawn, the last man and the last whore, going down like the moon over La Perla until they sleep or drown. And one more. This is a poem called The Best Halves of Our Lives, and it's about getting together with old friends once a year or so, and what passes between you at times. The poem was written when I was in Europe and far away from friends, and it was near a lake, so the images are of a lake. The best halves of our lives. The dark lake's emptiness spreads to its receding shores. The last red flag of day breaks down, and I look back and dream, patient for miracles. I am glad to be alone, to evoke your images around a table playing cards, old friends with little to say. At our feet, the dogs sleep fitfully. Our wives, who keep us together and apart, rise to remind us of our daily lives. I stand by the water watching clouds for whole days, remembering nothing at all. Here at the edges, less matters. I measure life by seasons away from friends, imagining each in his storybook house, writing letters which ascend with their secrets towards silence to settle miles away on my roof. And the angel in the lake, imperfect friend, finds me in this other place, grim with maturity and distance, watching a kingfisher and a swallow dip in a last evening flight and meet their shadows rising in the water. Thank you.